Hey, I'm Michaela LaFrac, the host of Vermont Edition. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela LaFrac. Today's show is part of our series of debates and candidate interviews ahead of the November 5th general election. And today, we'll be joined by three candidates for Attorney General. The position is responsible for advising states' attorneys and overseeing the enforcement of environmental, consumer protection, and criminal laws. Each candidate will have about the same time to respond to questions. Today, we're hearing from Republican Tor Nelson and the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Party nominee Kevin Gustafson, but we'll start with the incumbent Attorney General, Democrat Charity Clark. Clark won election in 2022 and made history doing so as the first woman in Vermont to be elected to the position. She was an assistant attorney general and chief of staff in previous Vermont administrations. Charity Clark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if you're elected, I'm wondering, give us sort of a bullet point. What would be at the top of your priority list?
Well, I think holding big corporations accountable, which is something I've been doing for the past 2 years since getting sworn in, would be a priority. This includes suing Meta and TikTok for harms perpetrated against Vermont's children. It includes suing Monsanto for contaminating Vermont's waterways, natural resources, and schools with their toxic chemical PCBs. Also, the pharmacy benefit managers who we recently sued. And of course, not a big corporation, but we did sue the FDA to make sure that the abortion drug mifepristone was accessible to Vermonters. Those kinds of lawsuits are going to be at the top of my list of priorities. I'm particularly interested in protecting Vermont's children. I have an eye towards Vermont's children, and that means holding, you know, big tech and big tobacco, and in some ways, you know, big chemical accountable for bad acts here in Vermont.
And Vermont recently got some money from a tobacco settlement lawsuit. Is that right?
That's right. It wasn't a lawsuit. We settled before the lawsuit came to be, which is the best way of handling things. And it was against Amazon. We have an online sales ban here in Vermont when it comes to tobacco products. You can't sell vaping products or any other products online. And Amazon was not doing enough to make sure that third-party sellers weren't violating that law. So we settled with them. It was just last week for $400,000. And they also are changing the way they do things to make sure that their preventative measures are going to be effective.
There's another issue that I know your office has been watching closely, and this deals with cybercrime, which has become a real problem. I mean, Vermonters lost $13 million due to cybercrime just last year. That's according to the Internet Crime Complaint Center. What is the Attorney General's office doing to protect consumers and raise awareness of ongoing scams?
This has been a real focus for me since before I even became Attorney General. This really relates to data privacy and issues that I think more and more Vermonters are becoming to understand as an issue. But there's so much of our data out there. And if there's ever a data breach, if there's a lot of data out there, you become vulnerable. So we have in Vermont and have had for like 15 years the Security Breach Notification Act. And those notifications come to my office. I think the webpage on our website where you know, we have that information is one of the most visited web pages on our website. And we get a breach notification more than one every day. So it's not a matter, for some businesses, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So it's really critical that we are doing work both from our office and with education, but also in the legislature to make sure that a comprehensive data privacy bill makes it across the finish line and we can begin to implement better practices when it comes to protecting people's data so that if there is a breach, that information isn't used to steal someone's identity or, you know, information that can be used against them to perpetrate a scam. So we do a lot of work in that space. I do consider myself to be, you know, one of the preeminent scam experts here in Vermont and will continue to work to protect Vermonters in the consumer space if I'm reelected.
Well, as a scam expert, what are some tips or some maybe red flags you could tell people to watch out for, especially during now? You know, we've got 2 weeks till an election. And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it around things like natural disasters, sometimes elections, that some of these scams start to become more prominent?
Yes. You know, there's a lot of specific scams that I could mention, but I want to instead share a kind of tool that you can apply to any situation. The way to spot a scam is if emotions are spiked, that could be excitement, worry, concern, and someone is trying to get you to give them money, there's a sense of urgency, and you don't know who they are, or you can't confirm who they are because mm-hmm. they're on the phone or something. And then if they ask you to pay in gift cards or cryptocurrency, some sketchy way of paying that doesn't have consumer protection built in the way credit cards do, red flag. Mm. Like, don't do it. Call the consumer assistance program at my office, which is 1-800-649-2424. If you ever encounter something like this, I'm telling you it's probably a scam. So that's, you can apply in any situation. And, you know, more we think of scams as being an attempt at stealing money from you. But you mentioned the election. And I, of course, am worried that the same tricks that are used to steal money from people in scams are going to be used to steal their vote. You know, convince them there's something going on that isn't going on. And we saw that back in the New Hampshire primary, someone made a deep fake of President Biden's voice before the election. So something to be on the lookout as we approach the election.
I want to shift now to crime that's more related to sort of street crime, you know, violent crime, that sort of thing. And we did see a rise in shooting-related deaths in Vermont, particularly between 2021 and 2022. Now, you were elected in 2022. I'm wondering if you can update us a little bit on deaths related to gun violence in the state over the last couple of years.
Well, we participate in the governor's gun violence safety task force. But in general, let me say, everybody deserves to not only be safe, but feel safe in their communities. And it's an important job for the attorney general to be a member of the kind of community in keeping people safe. For me, I prioritize prosecution of the most violent crimes. That includes murder, sexual assault, child sexual assault, and those kinds of cases. In addition, we work very closely with the state's attorneys. The state's attorneys are the county prosecutors elected in each county, and they are responsible for public safety in their counties. We work very closely. Sometimes we'll take a case over for them, you know, sexual assault case, a murder case. We also will co-chair a trial with them. Sometimes we're behind the scenes providing support. So we have a very collaborative relationship, and it's a relationship that I'll be looking to, you know, strengthen as the, you know, as the new second term begins.
FBI statistics show there were 14 homicides in Vermont in 2021. That number, though, jumped to 25 homicides in 2022 and then 27 murders in 2023. Vermont is still well below the national average, of course, for homicides. But I wonder if your office is concerned about the rise and wondering what it may be attributed to.
You know, of course, we're concerned. I think that we sometimes we don't want to remember the pandemic, but we had a very traumatic thing happen to us all over the world. And it, of course, happened here as well. And it, combine that with, you know, the opioid epidemic, which these, you know, decades on has really morphed into a situation where we have a lot of drug related crime. I think we're finding ourselves in this situation. It is very disconcerting. And I think it's going to require all of us who work in this safe in this space to collaborate and work together to keep Vermont safe and to make sure the public safety is top of mind.
Staffing issues have been a problem, especially with Vermont State Police. I know that 51 positions were unfilled, I think as recently as last year. I'm wondering what your office is doing about that to try to recruit more qualified officers for Vermont.
Well, we do not supervise any of the state police, but I will say I have two suggestions. One of them I've passed on. Most of the recruits for law enforcement positions are men. I know because I go every graduation to the Vermont Police Academy graduation. I really enjoy that. It's very uplifting and inspiring to see the officers graduate and their families supporting them. The first one I went to had one woman out of like 40. Hmm. And since then, it's been a couple more, but I don't think I've ever seen more than like 5 out of 40 or 50. If we could only be more effective at recruiting women to these positions, think of how many more applicants we would have for these jobs. So that's one thing I would say I would be, if I were in charge, I would be looking at, you know, how do we improve that? Is it childcare? You know, what are the issues we could be trying to do to, you know, invest? Because it would probably cost money, but to invest. The other idea that I talked about during the last campaign is the idea of a campus for the Vermont Police Academy that's not located in a far away from the urban center place. And that's what we have now. Pittsford is not close to Burlington, where there are so many other people. I think that that could be effective. Co-locating it at a college or university, I think, would be another, you know, new element where we're getting away from this kind of paramilitary style approach. And a lot of other people have talked about that. Again, I'm very interested in that and in both of those ideas to try to, you know, kind of change what we do when it comes to recruiting law enforcement officers.
We're speaking with incumbent Attorney General Charity Clark, and I want to piggyback on this topic here. I think it's a little bit related. You mentioned working with state's attorneys throughout Vermont, and I'm wondering about your view on restorative justice efforts. If you could maybe briefly explain what restorative justice is and whether or not that's something that your office is supportive of.
Well, I think restorative justice is critically important, and it is something that the Attorney General's office plays a very large role in, because our community justice unit oversees all of the restorative justice programming in the state. We provide grants to local nonprofits who are the restorative justice centers, or sometimes they're called community justice centers, all throughout the state. And we have, you know, therefore, this oversight of programming, and that includes like court diversion and now pre-charge, which a recent bill just passed, and we will be overseeing pre-charge as well, and pretrial services. So what we see with restorative justice is outcomes that are better for both the victim and also for the perpetrator. These are generally lower level crimes. There's an opportunity for intervention if there are issues related to drugs and alcohol or mental health. There, statistically, there's more healing that happens for the victim and more rehabilitation for the perpetrator. And I mean, critically, restorative justice plays a role in 20% of misdemeanors here in Vermont at this point. So it really is well established. It's been going on for decades here in Vermont, and I am a huge fan. And I'll just point out, you can include restorative justice in plea deals. You know, outside of those programs, you can include the restorative justice model. You asked kind of what is it, so I want to answer it. A sort of rough example would be, say someone had a lower level crime like, you know, disorderly conduct or something like that. And people, they were rowdy at a bar and hit someone and broke someone's flower pot. They might have a list of things that they're going to do to kind of address the harm. There might be what's called a restorative circle. People from the community volunteer to be a part of that circle. And it's very effective. I encourage, if anyone's listening and they're interested in this, I would encourage you to learn more, because it really is a great model, and I'm really proud of the work that our office does and the role we play in restorative justice.
So I'm assuming you'd like to see it expanded for accessibility as well, because we do hear that more rural, remote areas of Vermont don't have quite the access that, say, more of the urban centers like Burlington have for this.
Well, and that was part of the bill that passed, was, you know, expanding that geographic equity.
In the time we have left here, Charity Clark, I want to get to something you mentioned near the top, and this is the interest in suing the social media platform TikTok over allegations that they've created sort of like their platform is a little bit like slot machines. You've talked about this, you know, that it's essentially addictive for young people. Is that your view?
Well, yeah, it's designed to be addictive. So, you know, if you find yourself on a social media app like TikTok and you find yourself having trouble pulling away, that's by design. That's how they make money. In addition, TikTok not only has that problem with the design, but they also have a virtual strip club where there's an online virtual currency that is not registered as it should be. So it's operating illegally, and it entices, you know, young people to perform, you know, exploits them sexually and financially using that virtual currency. So they have that other element that I find so troubling. So yes, we recently sued them, and I'll continue to work on that case and try to protect Vermont's children.
Other states are involved in that as well, as I understand it. There's an interesting study out of Brown University School of Public Health that talks a lot about this. I will say, though, that there, you know, there is still a lot of data that we don't know about whether or not it is truly addictive, and I think it does have to be delved into a little deeper.
Well, I don't know that we agree about that.
Okay, we can agree to disagree on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
We are still waiting on this. It's certainly, listen, I've got a teenage daughter. I have the same concerns about Instagram and spending too much time on the phone that a lot of parents do. So I do appreciate your efforts in at least looking into this, and we'll find out more about it. I've been speaking with Charity Clark, the Democrat who is running for re-election as Vermont's Attorney General. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll start with Republican Tor Nelson. He's a longtime Berlin selectman and town administrator and a former federal investigator as well. Tor Nelson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What would your top three priorities, let's say, be if you are elected as Vermont's next Attorney General?
Excuse me. Well, my first priority would be crime, as you talked about in the prior segment. Crime, both violent crime and, you know, the lower level property crimes have just skyrocketed in Vermont over the past several years. In fact, the FBI statistics show in Vermont, the crime rate has doubled since 2014, you know, being both property crimes and the violent crimes. You know, talked about homicides earlier. Being here in Berlin, we're very business friendly as far as the town, and we have a large commercial district in town, and we see the effects of shoplifting and property crimes every day in Vermont, which are not being handled appropriately by the current court system.
What would your approach then? Oh, I'm so sorry. Go ahead, please. I don't want to.
To answer your question, I think first of all, as you know, the first speaker was talking about, you know, she's focusing on violent crimes. But, you know, she's very soft on property crimes, and this may get into other questions as well, but, you know, the attorney general needs to be, you know, I call it a force multiplier with the county state's attorneys. You know, most of these cases are handled by the county state's attorneys, but they have their own problems, their own staffing issues, their own caseload problems. And as, you know, we can work jointly together to, you know, best handle these cases in an effective resolution and not just to get them off the docket.
Well, Charity Clark was talking about being a fan of restorative justice, and that is something that she was pointing out is usually reserved for less violent, less serious crimes as a way to avoid, you know, somebody getting put into the system where they maybe, you know, do get arrested and put away for a longer amount of time for something that isn't as serious a crime, you know, because that can create a loop effect where there's recidivism, et cetera. What's your view of restorative justice, and do you feel like it could be a tool to use for less serious crimes?
I'm a big fan of restorative justice. We have a great diversion program here in Washington County that I feel is very effective. I also know there have been some work on drug courts in the state, in the southeast portion of the state, where they focus on treatment and rehabilitation rather than pure punitive punishments. But it's not you know, the perfect situation for everything. These cases need to be dealt with on a case by case basis, depending on the facts and the likelihood of success, and not just a wholesale. You know, we're going to shift all of these cases to, you know, diversion restorative programs, as some county state's attorneys currently do.
Tor Nelson, you mentioned the rising crime rates from the FBI statistics, homicides in particular. We have seen an increase in gun violence in Vermont. And again, you know, don't want to scare people because relative to the rest of the country, certainly Vermont is a safer place. But what do you think is driving a lot of this violent crime?
Well, I think there are several issues. You know, the first is drugs and mental health. We do not have the treatment programs in place to be able to handle either of them effectively. On top of that, the the homeless problems and the just the cost of living, you know, increases that everybody's facing nowadays. People are living paycheck to paycheck if they can even do that. And they're then forced into taking actions that they may not otherwise have taken without these pressures on them. And it's only getting worse. You know, we've seen the, you know, the inflation over the past several years. We've seen the education taxes this year, double digits in many places. We're seeing double digit increases in health insurance next year, and already seeing some preliminary numbers of education taxes going up again, double digits next year. Vermonters just cannot afford this anymore, and we need to get the legislature under control to, you know, stop these feel-good measures that really don't have any, you know, real positive effect on Vermonters' lives.
Well, the AG's office, of course, is not in charge of the state budget. I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of influence you could have as the Attorney General on some of these issues you're talking about. You know, it's certainly debatable whether or not those things you mentioned are driving crime. But, you know, again, that wouldn't be related directly to what your responsibilities would be as AG.
Well, as the AG, you know, keep in mind that, you know, they are the law firm for the state, basically, as a way to put it. And, you know, there's a lot of instances where the state signs contracts, and these contracts should at least be reviewed by the Attorney General's office for their benefit to the state. I mean, why is VTrans purchasing 20 acres of land when they only need 8 acres of land and they're paying double the listed value of it? I mean, that's right there is an indication of state agencies not working, and the Attorney General's office should be putting a stop to these contracts. Other contracts would be through the Agency of Digital Services, where, you know, multi-million-dollar computer systems are being contracted without going out to bid. And, you know, ADS staff is saying that these are bad systems. These systems just don't work. But yet the agency is just moving ahead and implementing them.
So you would maybe use the office to maybe coordinate or communicate a little better with legislators and bring some of these concerns to them and say, hey, you could be helping us out with reducing violent crime if you did X, Y, or Z.
I'm a big believer in partnerships, and I like to, you know, work together. And none of these issues are going to be resolved on their own, but I've got a proven track record of building partnerships. We've got a great partnership in Vermont called the Vermont Highway Safety Alliance, for instance. It came out of federal legislation creating the Strategic Highway Safety Plan and has since morphed into partnerships involving everybody's affected by highway safety, which is everybody basically who drives on the road. I would like to see the same types of partnerships with everything else the state does.
Let's move on to things like consumer protection, because Vermont, as you know, has sued multiple companies, including social media conglomerates. We heard Charity Clark talking about bringing the suit against TikTok, pharmaceutical companies. Is the state doing enough to protect Vermonters? And do you think these settlements are enough to change the practices of some of these big companies?
Well, I think the problem is that these suits do not really bring about real change. They're not effective. Yeah, they sound good that we're suing these multinational and international corporations, but in the end, you know, has Meta and Facebook really changed any of their processes? Is Meta you know, a better company today than they were a couple of years ago? You know, same with TikTok. You know, there's a whole lot of issues with TikTok. I use it. I find some of the posts, you know, extremely hilarious. And there is some good information on there. There's a comment that's visible, you know, right now. I think tonight even might be like the last night to see it, that I've been seeing some meteorologists, you know, talk about how to find this comet in the skies. You know, those are great posts. But there's also just a lot of junk out there. And everybody talks about the algorithm of TikTok and, you know, how it feeds you post that it thinks you would like. So you keep looking, or well, maybe the next one will be better. Maybe the next one after that. And just the whole concern about what data TikTok is collecting and retaining on you, you know, not just the addictiveness of it, but what it's going to be doing with all that data.
So am I reading you right in saying that you agree with bringing the lawsuit against TikTok as Charity Clark's office is doing?
Well, I think it's what is going to be the end result. If it's just going to be a sue and settle, her office has done so many times, but no real changes to the platform, what is that going to get us? Yeah, it gets us some money, you know, potentially in a settlement, but, you know, as I've, you know, just mentioned before, you know, the state has not been a real good steward of public money, and they'll squander this money as well.
Do you feel there are other areas or issues that the state should be looking at when it comes to these kind of suits?
Well, not just these kinds of suits, just the, you know, keep in mind, the Attorney General's office, just like, you know, all other state governments, you know, we've got limited resources, and it's a matter of what we put those limited resources towards in achieving effectiveness. I think, you know, focusing on crime, you know, working with the, you know, the county state's attorneys, partnering with the U.S. attorneys, you know, because a lot of times these, especially when it comes to the online scams, are, you know, national and international in nature and beyond just the resources here in Vermont.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I haven't asked you about that yet. I do want to ask about, you know, you don't have a legal background, Ternelson. You do have a law enforcement background, as I understand it. But what do you feel are your best qualifications to be Vermont's next attorney general?
Well, I think, first of all, my sense of fairness and my sense of what is right and wrong. While I've not been to law school, I do have 32 years of investigative service for the Federal Department of Transportation, in which I was very directly involved in initiating and even settling civil cases and other types of cases. We had a toolbox, we called it, various types of cases we could bring about. You know, my background's in law enforcement administration, which I did conduct, you know, did have a lot of law study in that, including criminal and constitutional law and civil law. Basically, law school style of classes back then.
And certainly, I would think that you are also going to be watching for cybercrime and the kind of things that Charity Clark was talking about. What would you do to prevent the kind of scams that prey on vulnerable Vermonters?
First of all, we need to, you know, have the education out there. And I know the incumbent is doing a great job trying to train, you know, the public how to look out and not be a victim. But we also need to strengthen our local law enforcement to be able to investigate these crimes. And you're not going to build that by creating a competitive culture as she currently has with law enforcement. You know, we have a detective here in Berlin who is very effective in checking into the, you know, the cell tower data and the phone usage and everything like that. In fact, he's going to training next week, additional training on that. I think just needs to be brought down, you know, through the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council. You know, let's not just have one or two officers here and there. Let's incorporate this into the, you know, to the regular training, you know, for all law enforcement officers.
I've been speaking with Republican Ternelson, who is running to be Vermont's next attorney general. Thank you so very much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on now to another candidate for attorney general of the state of Vermont. This is the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Party's nominee, Kevin Gustafson. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you much for having me.
And my first question to you, the same as I've asked our other two candidates today, if you are elected to the job of attorney general, what would be at the top of your priority list?
So I do think that there are two big priorities, and they've already been mentioned, but I think it's important, is the consumer protection And then obviously the criminal justice. And so on the consumer protection side, I do think that we are in a new gilded age, as it were, of trusts, and we need a new experience of trust busting. And I think to the degree that there are levers that the Attorney General in both one state or in conjunction with other states can join together in cases revolving either the kind of internet scams that we've heard about already on today's program, or indeed, I think one thing that hasn't been mentioned are, I think, price fixing or price gouging campaigns that have added to the sort of inflationary pressures that I think we're all feeling and that affect the most vulnerable of us even more. But there's a list of things in the consumer protection field. I think there's a rising, as my day-to-day job as an attorney, I've gotten just an increasing amount of calls revolving around specifically construction-related fraud, failures to complete projects, inability to, you know, register with different agencies to ensure that they're properly bonded and insured, and the consequences thereof. And so I think a refocus on that specific aspect of consumer protection is important. And then I think one of the other things that is often thought of as outside the purview of the Attorney General, but I think there are certainly ways in which the Attorney General can play a specific role, is the issue of housing. Hmm. While the Attorney General is not going to be necessarily building more housing, it certainly can work with our lawmakers on ways to figure out what role they could play in addressing availability of housing. And I think the one major way of doing that would be through reviewing housing discrimination, prosecuting those who are engaged in housing discrimination. And I think specifically to Vermont, the now sort of winding down of the motel housing program has in and of itself been, while potentially beneficial, has seen a lot of other effects that I think need to be addressed and need to be understood from both from the actual like consumer protection side of things, and I think that should be one of the things that's addressed. And so I'm sure we can go on to talk about, you know, the aspects of the criminal justice aspect of that, but I do think that consumer protection is among the most important thing that the Attorney General does. And I think that while a lawsuit against TikTok or Meta will certainly be a way to get into the news, I do share Tour's concerns about them and not having that much of an effect on a company as large as TikTok or Meta. And instead, we should be focusing on whether or not these organizations should be so large that those kinds of efforts may not actually change their culture.
And when I hear you talking about housing being an important issue, maybe not as directly related to the AG's office, are you making connections between the problem of homelessness in Vermont and then corresponding problems with crime? Do you see a connection there?
Absolutely. I think that there's a that even when you look at the issue of addiction and that's all related too. And I think that housing is a fundamental aspect of this. Having secure housing can often be the inflection point between whether or not you maintain a clean and sober life or whether or not you may find yourself back out on the streets and having to go into a life or at least a period of time in crime to be able to address your felt needs. And so, yes, I think that housing is a central factor that leads into other aspects that the Attorney General will have to address in its role as the sort of head of the criminal justice or the criminal prosecution, governmental action in Vermont. But I think that to the degree that there is a both, I think, an increase in the amount of corporate ownership and sort of housing and the discrimination that I think often does follow from that, that it inevitably leads to people finding it difficult, if not impossible, to actually find stable housing. And if you're not able to have a roof over your head, the ability to get into other aspects of what we might call antisocial behavior is one step away.
Kevin Gustafson, I find it interesting that the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Party is running a candidate for Attorney General, just to be frank about it, because when I think about the party itself, crime and issues related to crime don't immediately come to mind. What is the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Party's sort of approach to violent crime, petty crime, the kind of crime that, you know, the Attorney General's office is going to have to tackle head on if you were to be successful?
Well, the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Party is a sort of an avowedly socialist party, but it is a nonviolent socialist party. So our orientation is, you know, on the sort of the people, as it were. And I think that our approach to crime, or our way of understanding crime, is that it's in many ways and often not so much an issue of individual fault or some kind of locus of responsibility to be laid at the feet of an individual, but it's a societal problem. And so we have an economic system which is based fundamentally on the exploitation of working people's labor, and that is basically all that they have to offer. And when that even meager chance to be even have your labor exploited is not available to you, the need to have to purchase something like housing, purchase things like food, does not end. And so either you are forced to, as the saying goes, beg, borrow, or steal. Oftentimes you are just deciding day in and day out which one of those you're going to do to get your basic needs. And in a situation in a society which does not provision us with either the basic income necessary to be provisioned with our basic needs, or actually giving us our basic needs, there are going to be those who, for circumstances completely outside of their control, find themselves in a situation in which they are unable to get the so-called free labor that we use to get our paychecks day in and day out, and we'll have to find non-legal or extra-legal means in order to get the income that is necessary to get even the most basic of needs filled. And unfortunately, those who are able to do that are often not able to get even those basic needs filled until they do interact with the criminal justice system, because for a lot of people, the only stable housing they've had in a long time is a jail cell. And I do think that that's an indictment of a system that would rather spend all of the resources, of which Tor's right, we have a limited amount of, on prosecuting the individuals who are essentially the victims of a system that doesn't care about them, instead of provisioning them with what they would need at the beginning of their lives and throughout their lives, such that they would not be forced to turn to crime in order to get those needs met.
Well, based on what you just said, then I have to imagine that you are a supporter of restorative justice efforts, just as our last two guests were.
Absolutely. I think in my, you know, I've had number of different clients who have gone through the diversion program. I think that it's a great program generally. There are, I think, a lot of work that can be done to ensure, consistency throughout the different counties and the provision of that, of those programs. I do think some work much better than others, and we should be engaged in a constant process to learn what actually does work and what doesn't work, and have a dialogue between all of the different diversion programs and restorative justice programs to sort of identify what makes sense and what doesn't. I do think that, like all things, there are always ways to improve. But as a philosophical position, yes, absolutely, 100% in favor of restorative justice in many areas, and not even in some of the what you might call lower level crimes or nonviolent crimes or things like that. I do think that it's a sort of easy thing to say that, oh, well, you know, diversion is available for small things like, you know, if you get into a fight at a bar and break someone's, you know, flowers or something. Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes a lot of sense there. But we should also be thinking about restorative justice all the way up, even to some of, you know, violent crimes. It may not be the thing that satisfies, I think, our base human desire for a kind of retributive justice. But I think that when we are looking at what will create a society that is long-term sustainable and the kind of society that we want to live in, it would be a society that looks at individuals who are even doing some of the worst things they'll ever do in their life and say that they are not someone who deserves a life of absolute non-utility in an incarcerated setting, but instead ought to be given the tools that they did not have before then to be an active and contributing member of our society.
Kevin, I really appreciate your candor on that question, because you know you don't hear a lot of folks seeking political office who are willing to perhaps go that far. But I do wonder if that view, which may not jibe with, let's say, traditional law enforcement, would be something that you could bring to the job as Attorney General and talk to Vermont's state police and officers, et cetera, and say, that's a way I want to go. Would you be able to establish a good working relationship with Vermont's law enforcement officials if you were to be the next Attorney General?
Well, you know, as a volunteer firefighter down in Rutland Town, I mean, I've had a chance to work with a number of police and to hear, you know, some of their concerns. And obviously that you're talking day to day dealing with the consequences of the system I described. And so, again, it's difficult when you're in that position to try to take a sort of 30,000 foot view of how society and social factors come into creating the system that you're seeing day in and day out. But I do think that an effective attorney general would work with the police and could do so effectively, even taking a position that our goal is not to simply, allow anybody sort of quote unquote back on the street, but is to identify those who really need the kinds of things that can be offered so that they are not engaged in constant recidivism, thereby decreasing the amount of that the police are dealing with. And so if you take an approach and you understand it in a more holistic way, it's not potentially as easy to put into a soundbite, but it is actually a much more effective tool at actually addressing the thing that police officers are dealing with. And I think on top of that, if we just added something like, you're talking about not having the ability to recruit as many police officers. If we added a community resource officer to each of the police officers so that they could deal with the nonviolent or health mental health related issues, mm-hmm. Now you have a situation in which you're supporting police in some of the ways that are, I think, the most frustrating and difficult aspects of their job, which they should not be doing.
Kevin Gustafson is the Green Mountain Peace and Justice Center's candidate for Attorney General of Vermont. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And most of us here are laser focused on the upcoming November 5th general election. Can you blame us? But as the rest of the world is always trying to tell us, it's not just about the United States. And so we're closing out today's show with a conversation about our northern neighbors and the major political news coming out of Quebec. Here to guide us is Kathy Siné. She covers Quebec government and politics as a CBC correspondent at the National Assembly based in Quebec City, the capital of the province of Quebec. Kathy, so thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Mitch.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. I love talking about politics in Quebec, especially since we could use a little distraction here in the U.S. right now. I want to start.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I
must say that we discuss a lot about your presidential election in Quebec. I'm sorry. Every single day there is a stories coming out from the U.S. from our correspondents. So, yes, we discuss a lot about your election.
You anticipated my first question then. So this is on the radar, right? I mean, folks are very much keyed into this up in Quebec.
Yeah, it's pivotal because the United States is by far the most important commercial partner of Quebec, with an exchange of goods worth more than $31 billion just in the first semester of 2024. So when Donald Trump keeps repeating that he wants to renegotiate the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement or the UMSCA that took effect 4 years ago in order to save American manufacturing and bring back jobs, it creates uncertainty. And I must say that the Premier of Quebec, François Legault, is a former businessman. His government is focused on creating wealth in Quebec and reducing the richness gap between his province and Ontario, the biggest province of Canada that is actually our neighbor. Mind you, Democrats have also been protective of the country's economy over the years. But all of this is to tell you that Quebec's premier, his ministers, and Quebecers in general will be following the election night very, very, very closely on November 5th.
Is it unfair of me to ask if most Quebecers are leaning one way as far as who they would like to see president, whether it's Trump or Kamala Harris, who, by the way, spent five years of her life as a young woman in Montreal?
Yes, in Montreal, in the Montreal school. Yes. Well, I must say that perhaps the level of enthusiasm is higher with Kamala Harris than Donald Trump. Can I tell you that I worked in Ottawa in 2016, and I was there as a journalist when Donald Trump won the first time. So we tried the morning after to get reactions from the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his finance minister, and they didn't want to talk. There was so much nervous, like they were so nervous. They didn't see it coming. They were not prepared. So for sure now you have teams in Canada at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. You have teams in Quebec and also in the U.S. In the delegations working out in offices of Quebec. It's called Les Délégations du Québec. Those people are working days and nights to make sure that they do understand what's coming up. They do understand the implications. They do understand the impacts, and they will be ready. So they are talking to their colleagues, U.S. colleagues, all the time to make sure that they are ready and we know what's coming up.
Okay. I want to get to a topic that's particular of interest to folks in Quebec right now. It's the issue of immigration, which is a hot topic right here as well in the U.S. Can you explain to us what's at stake in Quebec right now when it comes to immigration?
Well, the Premier of Quebec, François Legault, is slamming the federal government for letting too many asylum seekers enter and staying in the province. And he's been repeating this for months. Quebec Premier believes it has received 45% of the number of total asylum seekers, as it makes only 22% of the Canadian population. So the Premier of Quebec keeps repeating that there are 600,000 asylum seekers in the province, and for him that affects public services, health and education services, because there are too many people. It also affects housing. In June, he added foreign students, temporary foreign workers and asylum seekers, and he said that temporary immigration was the main reason that the housing crisis was due to temporary immigration. And I'll add this, Mitch. Earlier this month, Premier Legault was in Paris, and he said to journalists that he wanted the federal government to force half of all asylum seekers to move elsewhere in Canada. So the federal minister, the federal immigration minister said that wasn't making sense, considering the protection of individuals for their freedom of movement under the Canadian Charter of Rights. And Ottawa went on listing all the changes it put in place over the last months, including bringing back visa requirements for Mexican nationals in order to curb asylum seekers. But then, for the Premier of Quebec, it's not enough, and it has also implications with the decline of the French language, especially in Montreal. So they really want in Quebec, this Quebec government, to protect the French language. So this is what's at stake. Can I tell you something about you guys in Vermont?
Sure.
I worked in a summer camp in 1996.
Very briefly, go ahead.
I worked in a summer camp in 1996. And it was called Kinia Camp. And I really wanted to tell you this and in order to improve my English skills. And my mom finished her high school in Newport.
Oh, no kidding.
Like a long time ago. Yes. So Quebecers are very close to Vermont. And in 1996, I do remember, like, it was the Olympic Games in Atlanta, and we won the gold medal. Like, Canada won the gold medal over the U.S., the 4x11, the 4x100 meters.
I remember it well. Kathy, I'm going to have to leave it there for you. I'm so sorry. I wish we had more time. We're going to have you back on for sure. And by the way, your English is excellent, certainly better than my French. CBC correspondent.
Every day. today.
Yeah, well, you're doing great. Kathy, CBC correspondent Kathy Sine in Quebec City, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. I really appreciate
it. Have a good day.
You too.